one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, we're going to recap the first two games of the series between the Phillies and the Red Sox up in Boston at Fenway Park. I'm going to let Justin and Liz take you through the rubber game that's going to be played on Thursday afternoon against Ranger Suarez, and they'll be able to give you all the details about that. But as I'm recording this here very late in the evening on Wednesday night, the Phillies split the first two games of their series against the Red Sox, losing 3-1 on Wednesday and winning 2-1 on Tuesday. So the bats have gone quiet this week. But we'll talk about the series. We'll talk about some interesting decisions by Don Mattingly. We'll talk about Kyle Schwarber's hot streak, Justin Crawford playing pretty well, good outings from Zach Wheeler and Andrew Painter. And coming up in just a few minutes, I'm also going to talk with Tim Brown, fantastic baseball writer, and he's the author of a brand new book, a biography about Nolan Ryan called Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. For those of us who watched baseball, grew up on baseball in the late 1980s and 1990s, we caught the tail end of Nolan Ryan's career, he had some memorable moments against the Phillies. So we're going to talk to Tim about all that stuff coming up on this edition of Hittin' Season. All right, let's talk about this series against the Red Sox. First two games, Phillies drop the second game of the series 3-1 on Wednesday night. Let's start off with the good news, okay? Let's start off with some happy thoughts. Let's start off with Andrew Painter, who had a nice bounce-back outing following some recent struggles on the mound. Remember his last time out against the A's, he only went 3 2/3 innings and gave up 8 runs in that game, 3 home runs, 3 walks, and 2 strikeouts. Before that, a 5-inning outing in which he gave up 3 runs on 7 hits, 5 2/3, gave up 5 runs against the Atlanta Braves. We were trying to get him through 6 innings, but couldn't do it. He had a four-inning outing, gave up 3 runs. His two best outings came in two of his first three starts. His opener against the Washington Nationals, he went 5 1/3, gave up just 1 run. And in his third game against the Arizona Diamondbacks, went 5 innings and gave up just 1 run. But against the Giants in San Francisco, had kind of a blow up. So it's been a pretty uneven, not going to say uneven. It's been not a very good start to the season for Andrew Painter. But On Wednesday night, he pitched pretty well and now has a 6.21 ERA on the season for young Andrew Painter. Not off to the kind of start that we were thinking we might see, but I think it was an encouraging outing. 5 innings, 4 hits, 1 run, no walks, and 4 strikeouts. And he finished his day striking out the side in the 5th inning. A couple of nasty sliders or sweepers or whatever he wants to call them to right-handers. And then he buried a fastball in on a left-handed hitter, got a check swing strikeout to end the 5th inning. And nobody expected that he was going to leave the game at that point. After 5 innings, he'd only given up 1 run on a Trevor Story home run. He had been cruising, no walks, like I mentioned just a second ago. Again, those 4 strikeouts in 5 innings. And he'd only thrown 62 pitches. Kind of cruising after striking out the side in the 5th. But in the 6th inning, it was not Andrew Painter who returned to the mound. Tanner Banks, the struggling left-handed reliever, started the 6th inning. Mattingly said after the game that he wanted to get his bullpen some work and that he wanted to get Andrew Painter out of the game feeling good about himself. And I can understand that. You heard me read off the game logs just a second ago. Andrew Painter has not been terribly good this year. He's had some blow-up outings. That outing against the Braves I just mentioned a minute ago, he was one out away from finishing a very promising 6 innings, but gave up a 3-run home run to Matt Olson that night, or a 2-run home run. I forget exactly how many runs were scored, but it cost him the win, cost him a chance at a good outing. And I think Don Mattingly just decided they wanted to get him out on the sooner side rather than the later side. And the bullpen did need a little bit of work because we'll talk about Zach Wheeler's start on Tuesday in just a second, but a couple of those guys hadn't pitched in more than a few days. And Tanner Banks comes in. He was fine, gave up a single around 2 outs, but then Orion Kerkering, who had not given up a run since April 17th, gives up a 2-run home run to Sedan Rafaela, and that was the ball game. Red Sox win 3-1. Now, in terms of the Andrew Painter decision, you can look at this from a short-term perspective or a long-term perspective. And To me, it seems as though Don Mattingly was looking at whether or not to pull Andrew Painter after five innings of, again, four hit, one run, no walk, four strikeout ball, 62 pitches. He probably had another at least two innings left in him if he maintained that kind of pitch economy. But if the goal is to get Painter out of the game feeling good, to set him up for the rest of the season, like stacking these outings. Let's stack some really good quality five inning outings. So that way you can start to maybe get through six and start stacking some six inning outings that way. But if you push him, like we saw them try to do earlier in the season against the Braves, and he gets in trouble, you want to, you could mess things up for him. He's a rookie pitcher. You know, he's still learning how to do it. He's been left in games an inning too long a couple of times this year, which is interesting to say, considering he very rarely has pitched deeply into games. But he was feeling good. And I think Mattingly was looking at the long view, thinking, we want this kid to be a big part of what we do here. We want this kid to develop. Let's get him out of this game feeling good. Now, we're going to talk about Nolan Ryan coming up here in just a few minutes. And I know one of the things in this Nolan Ryan book is, the book talks about the state of pitching and the fact that no one pitches deeply into games like Nolan Ryan did back in the day. And here you have Andrew Painter, a young buck, 23 years old, young arm, should be, I mean, yes, had the Tommy John surgery, of course, but man, this guy should be able to give you innings. He should be able to give you pitches. And Mattingly and the Phillies decided to play it very conservatively, but my guess is they wanted to give him confidence moving forward. And if this does that, if this, after striking out the side in the fifth inning, it makes him, he looks back at this outing against the Red Sox in Fenway Park and starts feeling better about himself and it triggers something else, then this would have been a good plan. But in the short term, meaning this winning this game, it was probably the wrong move. He should have kept Andrew Painter in the game until Painter started to get in trouble, but definitely have Tanner Banks warming in the bullpen and definitely have Orion Kerkering warming up in the bullpen in case Andrew Painter goes sideways, but I would have absolutely let him come out for the sixth inning. I mean, just 62 pitches. That's nothing. I would have at least tried to get him through or get another inning out of him. And although the offense only got three hits and scored one run, it probably didn't make much of an impact, even if you were overly concerned about the short term here. Wasn't likely to make a whole lot of difference because the bats dried up on Wednesday night. But did Mattingly pull Andrew Painter too soon? Long term, no. I get it. I see why he did it. Short term, yeah. Definitely the wrong baseball move in the moment. But it seems as though Mattingly was maybe thinking not quite so much in the moment. Now, the Phillies had a chance to at least tie the game in the ninth inning. Kyle Schwarber had a leadoff walk against Aroldis Chapman, but Bryce Harper struck out. Adolis Garcia struck out. Trey Turner, who did not start the game because he was sick, pinch hit and walked. But then Alec Bohm, with runners on second and third after they both pulled off, after Schwarber and Turner pulled off a double steal off of Aroldis Chapman to put runners on second and third and two outs. Alec Bohm chased two pitches out of the strike zone to strike out and end the ball game. I guess Elmo wishing for home runs. The magic of that only lasts about 48 hours. And now we're back to something else. It's just the Elmo effect did not last too terribly long. Justin Crawford continues to play well. He had a good game. One of the few players to have a good game on Wednesday night. He hit his second home run of the season. And folks, when you watch the highlights, if you didn't see the game live, he hit a bomb to dead center field. That is a place that not a lot of players go. So I got to tell you, this kid has some power. He hits the ball hard, and if he can elevate the ball, he could. That ball traveled well over 400 feet. An impressive home run from Justin Crawford off of Sonny Gray in this game. Really, really nice swing. I mean, Tom McCarthy was surprised. It looked like Jaron Duran, I believe, was playing center field here on Wednesday night, was going to catch it, and then he's like, oh, maybe it's going to go over his head. No, it's over the fence. And then he had a really nice sliding catch in center field to rob a single. I think it was in the fourth inning. He came running in, sprinting in. He had to play deep because it's a very, very deep center field at Fenway Park. So he was playing pretty deep, and it was a two strike pitch that the hitter just kind of popped into center field, and he had to come a long way to go get it. But Justin Crawford made a very nice athletic sliding catch in center to rob a single. And I don't know, I've seen plenty of Justin Crawford in center field this year. There's a lot of work to do there, but is he the worst defender in baseball, as defensive runs saved would tell you? He's not. He's not, but it is dragging down his wins above replacement right now. And I've got a pretty amazing Justin Crawford stat coming up here in just a few minutes that I'm going to tell you about. But the rest of the offense went cold against Sonny Gray. Kyle Schwarber's streak of games with a home run was snapped at 5. He had homered in 5 straight games coming into the game on Wednesday, but that ended. And Bob Nightingale of USA Today noted that the Phillies, after losing 3-1 to the Red Sox, have failed to score more than one run in 10 of their 43 games this season. They've also produced 3 or fewer hits in 4 games this year. But the Phillies have failed to score more than one run 10 times so far this year. 10 of their 43 games. That is a wild number. And I think most of this is due to the lack of production from right-handed hitters. It's one of the reasons why this team has struggled against lefties. It's one of the reasons why you can't really expect the Phillies to win the finale on Thursday against a left-handed starter, by the name of Ranger Suarez. And that'll be a very interesting matchup. But the Phillies right now do not have a right-handed regular, and I'm going to include Edmundo Sosa in this, with an OPS of 650 or higher. Actually, Luke Arcaney noted this on Twitter, and I've done a little bit more digging onto this. Did you know that the top 4 OPS numbers on the Phillies all belong to left-handed hitters? 3 of them, I'm sure you can guess. Schwarber at 963, Harper at 892, and Brandon Marsh at 864. But Justin Crawford has the 4th highest OPS on the Phillies at 757. It is a higher OPS than any of the right-handed hitters I'm about to talk to you about. No right-handed hitter has an OPS above 650. Matter of fact, next on the list, 5th on the Phillies in OPS, is Adolis Garcia at 650. Edmundo Sosa is at 637. Trey Turner is at 632. JT Realmuto is at 588. Again, remember, these are OPSs, kids. And Alec Bohm has a 529 OPS this season. This is going to be a big deal if this team doesn't start to get production from the right-handed hitters. The Phillies are playing better. They're now just 3 games under 500. There's no doubt about the fact the pitching's been better under Don Mattingly. They're getting more hits. Kyle Schwarber's been on a crazy rampage right now. But if these right-handed hitters don't start producing, if Justin Crawford finishes the season with the 4th highest OPS on the team, he's either had a rookie of the year type season, or this offense is going to struggle in a major, major way. And I want to zero in on one of these right-handed hitters, Adolis Garcia, who's overall back of the baseball card numbers right now look exactly like I thought they would have, and they look exactly like they have the last 2 years when he was one of the worst hitters in baseball. He went 0-for-4 with 3 more strikeouts on Wednesday night. And after Wednesday night's game, his batting average is .227. He has an on-base percentage of .292 and a slugging percentage of just .357. Those are abhorrent numbers. Now, let's just dive behind the numbers. 4 home runs and 6 doubles. Not a lot of power production there from a guy who is one of the strongest men on the team. But let's take a look behind the curtain at some of these numbers and wonder, is there a possibility some of these numbers start to turn around for Adolis Garcia? His walk rate is up slightly, 7.8% to 5.1% over last year, but it's the same as it was in 2024 when he had a terrible season. So I think the walk rate is kind of noisy right now. But some of these other numbers suggest that his production might get a little bit better. His line drive rate of 24.8% is the highest of his career right now. He's hitting more line drives than at any point in his career. His hard hit rate of 42.2% is tied with his 2023 number, which we all remember was his breakout season, the year the Rangers won the World Series and Adolis Garcia went crazy in the playoffs. That was the year that really he had his best season. He was in the 91st percentile in average exit velocity. He's in the 87th percentile in hard hit rate, and he's in the 73rd percentile in sweet spot percentage, 70th percentile in squared up percentage. So if you look at those numbers, he's hitting the ball really hard. He's not hitting the ball on the ground a ton more. It's mostly he's exchanging fly balls for line drives. His hard hit rate is tied for one of the best numbers of his career. And among all these different players in baseball, he is among the best at average exit velocity. Hits the ball comes off his bat faster than most. Hard hit rate faster than most. Sweet spot, hitting it on the sweet spot. More than most. 70th percentile in squaring the ball up, but just 4 home runs and 6 doubles. So I think with Adolis Garcia, at least we should start to see some of these other numbers trend in a better direction. All right, let's talk quickly about Tuesday's win. The Phillies beat the Red Sox 2-1. It was a nip and tuck game for basically the entire way through. Zach Wheeler was fantastic. 7 1/3 innings, 6 hits, 1 run, no walks, 4 strikeouts. His ERA now on the season down to 2.55. He's just having a really nice comeback from this thoracic outlet syndrome. Batters are hitting just 193 against him. But whereas Adolis Garcia had some peripheral numbers that were really encouraging, I think it's fair to ask, is Zach Wheeler, can we believe in this, what we're seeing from him so far? His strikeout rate of 23.2% is way down from last year's 33.3% and down significantly from 2024's 28.5%. In fact, it's among the lowest strikeout rates of his career. But he is exchanging strikeouts for ground balls. His ground ball rate has exploded. It's 48.5% so far this year. That would be his highest since his first full season in Philadelphia in 2021, the year he finished runner-up in the Cy Young. And that year, it was only 39.9%. 48.5% ground ball rate for Zach Wheeler so far here in 2026. Now, a lot of these ground balls are hit hard. The hard hit rate and barrel rates are both up for him. Hard hit rate is 37.9%, just shy of 38%. It was 24.5% last year. And over his career, it's a little over 28%. So a lot of these balls are getting hit hard, but a lot of them are getting hit on the ground and they're turning into outs. And his fastball is averaging about 94.7 miles an hour, which is about a mile and a half per hour slower than it was at the beginning of the season last year. So can we believe in this? Can we believe that a reduced fastball velocity and a much higher hard hit rate, can we believe that Wheeler will keep the ball on the ground enough to be really effective like he has been so far? And maybe this is part of the maturation process. Maybe he's got plenty of electric pitches to get guys out, as we have seen so far. I do think we should be prepared for a little Zach Wheeler regression. I think that 193 batting average against is going to go up. And I think he will probably end up finishing the season with an ERA over 3. I don't think it's going to be under 3. But right now, it's really great to see him doing what he's doing, and he's figuring it out. He's finding a way to get through these lineups and do it very effectively, do it very efficiently, too, as a matter of fact. And of course, I would be remiss not to marvel at Kyle Schwarber. Kyle Schwarber homered on Tuesday for the first run of the game and extended his homer streak to 5 games in a row. Now, again, I mentioned on Wednesday he was not able to go yard, but because of this crazy streak that he is on right now, Kyle Schwarber is your major league leader in home runs with 17 bombs on the season. Aaron Judge is right behind him at 16. Byron Buxton and Munetaka Murakami are tied with 15 home runs. So Kyle Schwarber doing what he's going to do, hitting bombs. It's a lot of fun to watch him right now. And we talked a lot about it on the last podcast. The race to 400 is on between him and Bryce Harper.
Well, as a child of the late 1980s and 1990s, growing up, cutting my teeth on baseball during that time, there were few baseball players around that generated as much interest and fascination as the great Nolan Ryan. And as Phillies fans, there were a number of moments during Nolan Ryan's career that connected him to the Phillies. Of course, Game 5 of the 1980 NLCS being one of them, and then that unbelievable chase that he and Steve Carlton with back and forth for the strikeout record, the all-time strikeout record in 1983 and 84. Just amazing stuff that Nolan Ryan has been connected to with the Phillies. And joining me to talk about a really great new book about the life of Nolan Ryan is Tim Brown. Here's the book, if you're watching this on the YouTube, Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. It's a fascinating read. Tim, thank you so much for joining me here on Hittin' Season. How are you?
I'm terrific, John. Thanks for having me, man.
It's great to talk to you. I know you got a chance to sit down with Nolan Ryan, but you also worked with his wife, Ruth, and his three kids in putting this book together. And what was the impetus behind deciding to write about Nolan Ryan? What are you saying as now he's, you know, later in life, he's 30 some odd years away from the game right now. Where is he right now in life?
Well, he's literally, he's in outside of Round Rock, and they have the minor league team in Round Rock, and he's got his ranches, and he still gets in the car with his dog Buddy and drives to the ranch. And like he told me, I like to be around when the calves hit the ground. they've got grandchildren, and he still has all his businesses, the Nolan Ryan beef and all that. Figuratively, I think he's where, and I think this is sort of where we related a little bit, is 78, 79 years old. He's been married to Ruth for going on 60 years.
Man.
And like a lot of us, I think I found Nolan in a place where he was looking back and making some decisions about what he did well and what he might want back. And there weren't a lot of those, honestly. I think he's just sort of considering how it all went, you know. Yeah. And I think he's pretty satisfied. Like all of us, his body's falling apart a little bit, but I found him to be in a good mood and sort of, I think, happy to talk about it all again.
You can read all of the records that Nolan Ryan set. And I think you mentioned in his book that he has 53 pitching records, which is more than any other pitcher in Major League Baseball history. But there's just 27 Major League seasons, seven no-hitters. Seven. Folks, hear that. Seven no-hitters. 12 one-hitters. That means there were 12 other times he was one hit away from a no-hitter. 18 two-hitters, 31 three-hitters, career strikeouts, 5,714. Just the number of innings, the number of seasons, the number of games that he pitched in. Can you try to articulate to people who did not watch this man, not only in his prime, but the fact that he had an extended level of success into his 40s, and the fact that he did all of this, amassed all of these innings, all of these games, and was one of the hardest throwers in baseball? It just doesn't compute with what we know about baseball today.
Right, John. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this book is because I have found myself over the past, say, 15 years, watching starting pitchers come off the mound, give the ball up 5 1/3, 5 2/3, get a standing ovation, tip the cap, you know, great job, way to go, buddy.
Yeah.
You see no hitters end in the seventh inning because they're at 104 pitches. And I'd be watching and I'd think, oh, where have you gone, Nolan Ryan?
Yeah.
How did this happen? And so I went to find Nolan Ryan. That was sort of what the book was about. But, here's an example. So arguably the best three pitchers of the generation that's just ending, Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer, Clayton Kershaw, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could bicker, but they pitched a combined, I want to say 60 years. They threw a combined 63 complete games.
Hmm.
Nolan Ryan in 27 years threw 222 complete games. And there are guys with plenty more than that. It was a sort of a generational thing. You know, if you liked your Seaver or you liked your Jenkins or you like your Carlton or whomever, it was just sort of a different world there. And when you take Nolan Ryan retired in 93, Justin Verlander's rookie year was 2005. That's 12 years. The game changed that much in 12 years. And I just sort of wonder, I mean, we all saw why it happened, right? You know, you have little leaguers and high school kids and college pitchers and, you know, their arms were being abused, and this was the correction, right?
Yeah.
But now in the meantime, we chase velocity. We're velocity obsessed while being super risk averse. And I just don't think those two things get along. Whereas in Nolan's day, particularly in his prime, and a lot of guys' primes, that those things weren't, you know, you threw as hard as you threw. You lasted as long as you could last. I'll let you know when you can leave the game. There'll be no like looking over to the dugout like, hey, I got my five. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Come get me. You know, one of the great old lines from Nolan was, you know, it's late in the game and he's gasping and there's runners on and the lead's in jeopardy. And Tom House goes out to the mound and says, how you doing? And Nolan says, I'm honestly doing terrible, but I'm a lot better than anything you got in that bullpen.
Right.
And I think so. That's sort of the baseball element of this. I think beyond the numbers, anyone can look at the numbers. I was really sort of interested in the legacy of it, right? The more than the numbers, the way he pitched, the way he carried himself, who he was, what it meant to face him, what it meant to be his teammate. And, you know, I don't think anybody, he saved a franchise in Texas.
Yeah.
He became sort of synonymous with Texas. And so there was a lot of elements to this that just went beyond, okay, you know, I can read his baseball reference page, but there was so much more to the man and the pitcher than just that.
Yeah. And so how does he feel about where the game is right now? Because like you mentioned, he probably even at 70-60% in the eighth inning at 140 pitches is probably still better back in those days than whatever bullpen arm you would have called on. Bullpens today are so much different. Now everybody comes out. And I would say, you know, the top three guys in virtually every team's bullpen is better, more electric than maybe the top three relievers in all of baseball during the time that Nolan Ryan was pitching. So there's no incentive for managers to keep starting pitchers in games longer and stretch them in the way that Ryan and Carlton and like Burt Blylevin and all those different kinds of guys were stretched back in those days. How does he view the game now? Because it's obviously very much different.
Well, you know, we know that he tried to resurrect sort of something more like himself when he was in the front offices with the Houston Astros and the Texas Rangers, that he still believed that, you know, the next Nolan Ryan could actually be out there. And that just the way the game was going, it wasn't going to allow it. I mean, you know, the next Nolan Ryan could have come and gone. Right. The next Nolan Ryan may be in somebody's minor league system, but we'll never know. He's never thrown more than 100 pitches. He's never pitched on 3 days rest. He's never, you know, pitched himself out of a problem in the eighth inning. So, you know, Nolan tried to drag it back into, you know, the 70s and the 80s, and it didn't go great. The guys just hadn't by then. By the time you get to the minor leagues, the die is cast a little bit, and you've already been so protected over the years. And I get it, you know, and nothing bugs me more than someone who brings up a problem but doesn't come with a solution as well. But I don't know if there's a solution. But I will say that it doesn't appear to me that injuries are down. You know, the whole game rests on an inch-long piece of ligament in an elbow.
Yeah.
It just teeters there on top of that thing. And we haven't solved that yet. You know, limiting innings and limiting pitches and allowing, you know, actually chasing all this velocity has sort of left us in the same spot that we were before we started doing all this.
Oh, and that's what's amazing about Ryan is he never chased velocity. He just had it. He was just blessed with it. And I think that's what's hard for people to understand is Nolan Ryan would have fit in beautifully with today's pitchers, with the arsenal that he had and the stuff that he had. And yet he never won a Cy Young Award, right? I mean, one of the most bizarre things is this guy had never won a Cy Young Award. And you look at his win-loss record, you know, he had a lot of losses a lot of seasons. He had some seasons with very high ERAs, you know? So he was not a perfect pitcher by any stretch of the imagination, but he wasn't a guy who had to chase the velocity that a lot of guys are chasing now. And that's what made him so unique, I think. And,
You also spend a lot of time in the book talking about the man himself, and I don't want to lose that because the baseball stuff is obviously fascinating. But there's a number of stories that you relate in the book, and there's one about him paying college tuition for an Astros bat boy whose dad has died. I'd like for you to tell that one.
Yeah, I was really taken by this story, and one of Nolan's teammates said in the process of reporting out this book, he said, "Hey, have you talked to Sid Holland?" And I said, "No, who's Sid Holland?" And he said, "You need to go find Sid Holland." And so I did. And Sid Holland runs a batting cage in Houston. And the backstory is Sid's father was a guy named Virgil. And Virgil ran the umpire's room at the Astrodome from the day it opened until the day he died. And Sid, as a young teenager, would get on the bus from Trinity Gardens neighborhood in Houston and after school and go help his dad at the Astrodome. And eventually he would roll into bat boy, ball boy, clubby, all the things that young, generally men do at ballparks. And Sid's dad died young and left Sid and his mom and Sid's siblings, to their lives. And it was very difficult, but Sid kept showing up at the Astrodome and he would give his paychecks to his mom. And in the meantime, he was also playing ball and he was, hoped to be a ball player like his heroes over at the Astrodome. Well, one day in the dugout, Nolan was along with a handful of other players, asked Sid near his senior year in high school, "Hey, Sid, what are you going to do? You're going to go play ball in college?" And Sid said, "Well, I would like to, but, these things happen, and I don't have a lot of money, and there's not a lot of scholarships out there. So, I guess I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing." And Nolan said, "Hey, follow me." And Nolan cut him three checks, one for room and board, one for tuition, and one to fly him to Texas Pan American so he can go to school and play baseball. And Sid eventually got a scholarship. He got drafted by the Rangers. And one day they bump into each other, Nolan toward the end of his career, Sid just at the beginning of his career. And Sid said, "Hey, Nolan, I just want to let you know that I'm going to pay you back." And Nolan said, "Sid, just be kind to the next person. Pay it forward. That's all I ask." And so he has. That's what he's done with his batting cage.
That is such a fun story. Talk a little bit about his life growing up. I know his dad was a hard worker, and Nolan obviously was a tireless worker. You could see that in the amount of innings that he pitched and how he grinded out. I think you described him in the book as a hard man who did hard things. I've never talked to the guy, but that sounds about right.
Yeah. I think The metaphor for me all along was when Nolan was a boy in Alvin, Texas, his job was to paint the house. And he never knew when this duty would fall to him, but he would come home from school one day and there would be, 10 new paint cans in the garage and a couple fresh brushes, and he knew it was time to paint the house again.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad was a tough guy who worked two jobs. And he knew that Nolan knew that there was an expectation that hard work was expected, that jobs were to be completed. And from the moment that that job began, one brushstroke meant all of the brushstrokes. Mm. You got it done. You finished it. And I think that sort of symbolizes the man, the life, the career. One brushstroke means all the brushstrokes. You finish the job and you do it well. And his dad would come home from work every day and he would look at the house and he'd nod or he'd point. You'd rather have the nod because the point meant something was wrong.
Yeah.
And so that's how I think Nolan sort of learned what responsibility and showing up and working hard and, answering to the people who expect things of you.
I thought one of the most surprising things, we mentioned the fact that he'd never won a Cy Young Award. I thought one of the other fascinating things, and I didn't realize this until I saw it in your book, was he had never won a World Series and only went to one World Series in his rookie season. Actually, he did win a World Series, I'm sorry, with the 1969 Mets. He won the World Series. He never won a World Series game, I think is what. And he got earned a save in that 1969 Miracle Mets World Series, but then never appeared in another World Series after that. And I wonder if he looks back on that Game 5 against the Phillies. I mean, he was 3 innings away, and he had the ball in his hand with a 3-run lead in the 7th inning to get back to his second World Series, and the Phillies kind of took that away. And we remember it, obviously, euphorically, but I imagine for Nolan Ryan, that had to be a very, very difficult pill to swallow.
Yeah, I think in a career that doesn't hold a lot of regrets for him, I think he felt like he emptied it out about as well as a man can. That one sticks to him, you know, I think in particular, because that's the sort of game that Nolan gets better, finishes it out, and he didn't. And I think he thinks about if that were the game, and you're right, he was a very young man with the Mets then. And, you know, I think a lot of them, Seaver was another guy who never went back to a World Series after that one. All assumed that they were going to go back, and I think that was their chance. I think 86 was another year. You know, they had a good team, and they had the Mets down, right? And if they had won that game 6 with Mike Scott,
right,
who at the time was unhittable, waiting in game 7, or was it 4 and 5, whatever the numbers were. But those two, I think those two series are the ones that sort of stick with them still, even in spite of all the other stuff that may have happened.
I forgot about the 1986 team. Yeah, that was man, heartbreaking for the guy. I think for a lot of fans who, like, you know, they're kind of in this online clip verse, they've seen the Nolan Ryan brawl with Robin Ventura, and you talk about that in your book a little bit. I wonder how he looks back on that. On that epic brawl that he had, where he had Nolan Ryan in the headlock and was punching him on the top of the head, and what their relationship is now, these many years later.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the challenges of writing a book, John, like this, about someone who is so well known that people just assume, I already know everything about Nolan Ryan. I've read about Nolan Ryan. I've thought about Nolan Ryan. I see his numbers. Is, you know, what are you going to provide people that they haven't seen before? And I think the way I approached the Robin Ventura brouhaha was almost 20 years later. Nolan's president of the Rangers, and Robin is going to manage his first game for the White Sox. I think this is 2012 in Texas. And Nolan, before the game, turns to his PR guy, been there forever, John Blake, and says, you know, I feel bad that they're going to boo Robin here today with the full ballpark, and it's opening day, and it's a new job for him. And John looked at him and said, Nolan, they've been booing him for years here. I don't know. It's not going to be any different than it ever was. And Nolan said, I still feel bad about it. So he went down pregame and met with Robin, and sort of, they, you know, buried the hatchet a little bit. They shook hands. They wished each other luck. Robin told him, hey, you know, you've done a great job here. And Nolan told him, you're going to be a great manager. And I think they finally sort of finished off whatever started on that mound in Texas 19 years before.
That was a heat of the moment thing. Boys will be boys, right, Tim? I mean, that's how that goes.
Dude, I'll tell you what, I don't know how much time you've spent in Texas, but you cannot walk into a sports bar or really any kind of restaurant and not see a picture of poor Robin Ventura, who was this terrific player, a really
elegant,
good player.
Yeah.
You know, in the crook of Nolan's arm. And I just feel bad. This is what this guy is remembered for. I really tried to have a lot of empathy for him going into this thing, because it's, you know, you make one decision that maybe you'd probably like to have back, probably. And, you know, it's still now, all these years later, 33 years later, what you're remembered for. And conversely, that was sort of Nolan's sort of swan song. That was his, you know, he was only had a couple months left in his career. And that really sort of sort of cemented his status in Texas after all those years. This is how you ride into the sunset, by whooping a kid who had the gall to come out onto your mound. And that's, you know, he was a hero going into that thing, but then he became, you know, legendary.
Yeah. Heroes get remembered, but legends never die, right? Isn't that the line from The Sandlot? At 100%,
that's exactly
right.
Exactly it, yes.
Well, it's a terrific book about a legend, Tim, and it's a fascinating read. And there's a whole generation of baseball fans who didn't get to watch Nolan Ryan who should absolutely get this book. Again, I'm going to show it for everybody. Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. Tim Brown, thank you so much for joining me here on Hittin' Season to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
John, it's been a treat. Take care, man.
All right, well, as I mentioned, on Thursday, the Phillies will take on old friend Ranger Suarez. I was watching Ranger Suarez. Some fan took a video on their phone of Ranger Suarez throwing sunflower seeds at Paco Figueroa, the Phillies' first base coach, trying to annoy his first base coach. And Ranger has said all the right things this week. He still loves all those guys on the team. Part of his heart is still in Philadelphia. I think it's going to be a bittersweet day watching him twirl against the Phillies, and you just kind of get the feeling, yeah, they'll probably hit a ball hard back to him at the mound, and he'll do one of those casual flips to first base that make the opponents really mad. But in Philadelphia, we loved him a whole lot, so it'll be a little sad to watch him on Thursday afternoon. But the Phillies really are due to hit around a left-handed starter. I'm not sure it's going to be Ranger Suarez, but the Phillies will be looking for their fifth series win in a row if they can figure out a way to take down their old pal, Ranger Suarez, on Thursday afternoon. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Please, folks, tell your friends and family members about this Hittin' Season podcast, this fine Phillies podcast, as we are taking you through what we hope will be a very fun and adventurous season. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcasts. And please feel free to send us an email, hittinseason@billypenn.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.